The headlines, President Vladimir Putin hails Russia's growing ties with Iran as he meets President Ebrahim Raisi. Russia says the U.S. will become a party to the conflict in Ukraine if it supplies long-range missiles to Kiev. Plus, millions of Muslims are on a pilgrimage to the holy shrine of Imam Hussein in the Iraqi city of Karbala. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran's president says cooperation among countries targeted by U.S. sanctions will make them stronger.
The relationship between countries that are sanctioned by the U.S., such as Iran, Russia, or other countries, can overcome many problems and issues and make them stronger.
The Iranian president said Americans think by imposing sanctions against a country, they can stop it, but they are wrong. Referring to the JCPOA revival talks, Raisi censured the Western states for proposing to hold negotiations while at the same time imposing new sanctions. He said they need to demonstrate goodwill for the revival of the 2015 deal. Raisi is in Uzbekistan to attend the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit. He made the remarks in a meeting with his Russian counterpart. He said Iran and Russia can offset the effects of U.S. sanctions by joining their forces. The two presidents underscore the resolve to enhance strategic ties. The president of Russia said that relations with Iran are positively developing.
Relations between Russia and Iran are developing on all the vectors that have been formed in previous years. We are in the final stage of working on a new major treaty between Russia and Iran, which will mark the developing of relations at the level of a strategic partnership.
Putin said a delegation from Russia with representatives of 80 large companies will visit Iran next week. The Russian president welcomed Iran becoming a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. On Wednesday, Iran signed an SCO, a moratorium on the commitments and arrangements, getting one step closer to becoming the eighth member of the regional body. Iran's accession is expected to be finalized by April 2023. We talked to political analyst Fuad Izzadi about the significance of Iran joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Let's take a listen.
I think it's both is in interest of Iran to be a member of SCO, and also it's good for SCO to have Iran as a member. Iran is an important Asian country. Iran is number one in terms of oil and gas. It's very much energy rich. And Iran, in cooperation with Russia, could basically provide the energy needs of the Asian continent. And given the historic role of Iran, given the civilizational background of Iran, and given the fact that many of the countries that are member of the SCO are culturally, religiously related to Iran, Iran being part of the SCO is going to be important. And also given the fact that Iran is under sanctions, cooperating both economically and trade and other linkages, economic linkages that Iran will have with SCO countries would be beneficial for Iran to go around sanctions. And we know Russia is under sanctions. China increasingly is facing sanctions from the United States. So this is what I was referring to earlier, that you are seeing the earliest stages of a new world order where Asian countries are going to cooperate more and have the United States leave this part of the world. They can stay in the North American continent. It's large enough for them. They don't need to be poking other countries, especially in Asia.
Now we're joined by Ahmad Qasimzadeh, Eurasia and Caucasus Affairs expert joining us from Georgia. Mr. Ghassem Zadeh, if you could please tell us more about the significance of Iran becoming a full member of the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
Regarding the significance of Iran's membership in the SCO, it should be noted that the organization includes several countries such as China, India, with a high population, almost half world population, with major economic benefits for member states. I can also refer to security matters. The SCO summit can be considered as the NATO of the East, and that includes the economic, political, and security spheres. It can bring about the interests and benefits for member states.
How can that change the global equations, the political equations on a global scale?
To elaborate on this, I have to tell you that what the Western Bloc is seeking, led by the U.S., is the creation of a unipolar structure so that it would dominate the whole world from the perspective of political and economic decisions. So the countries membering the SCO can somehow create a new space for countries that are not in convergence with the Western Bloc. Countries such as Iran, Russia, and China, they are not in convergence with the U.S. with respect to regional and global issues. So such cooperation can strengthen these countries and make these countries benefit from the options just created by the SCO.
Thank you very much. Ahmad Ghassem Zadeh, Eurasia and Caucasus Affairs expert, joining us from Fergan. In the meantime, China and Russia have held talks on the sidelines of the Shanghai Cooperation Summit. President Xi Jinping has told his Russian counterpart that Beijing is willing to work with Moscow as major powers in the face of global changes.
Facing an ever-changing world, era, and history, China is willing to make efforts with Russia to assume the role of great powers and play a guiding role to inject stability and positive energy into a world rocked by social turmoil.
Vladimir Putin, for his part, commended China's, quote, balanced position on the conflict in Ukraine. The Russian president also sided with China over the issue of Taiwan. He censured the U.S. for provocations over the island. Putin also said attempts by Washington to create a unipolar world will fail. That was the first in-person talks between the two presidents since Russia launched its military operation in Ukraine late February. Also, Russia says the United States would, quote, cross a red line if it decides to supply Ukraine with a long-range missile system known as HIMARS. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova warned if Washington does so, it would become a party to the conflict. She said Moscow reserves the right to defend its territory. The U.S. has supplied Ukraine with advanced rockets. Washington says Kiev has promised not to use them to strike Russian territory. In the meantime, the United States is preparing to send Ukraine another package of security assistance. Ukraine has requested and received large quantities of weaponry from the United States and its Western allies in the face of the Russian military operation. Moscow says that the operation is aimed at preventing Ukraine from being used as a platform for Western aggression. Now, Tehran has censured Washington's new sanctions against a number of Iranian individuals and entities over alleged cyber threats. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said making false propaganda and spreading disinformation about the Islamic Republic is part of Washington's failed policy of Iranophobia, and it will get nowhere. He said such, quote, sordid, illegal, and twisted behavior towards independent nations shows that the U.S. politicians are unable to understand the global equations or adapt themselves to the realities of the world. The official said Iran itself has been a target of cyber attacks. He said the Islamic Republic has therefore been an important part of international efforts against such activities. Kanani said Washington has always turned a blind eye to cyber attacks against Iran's infrastructure and even its peaceful nuclear activities. He said the U.S. has even directly and indirectly supported such attacks. On Wednesday, the U.S. imposed sanctions on 10 Iranian individuals and two entities, accusing them of, quote, malicious cyber activities. Elena Duhan, the special UN rapporteur, has presented her report to the UNHCR. The scathing report recounted the effects of sanctions, pointing out how U.S. sanctions severely impact the economies and lives of people, especially in the case of Iran. Still, the question is whether the U.S. will be held to account or can do anything to prevent or stop these sanctions.
Elena Duhan is the UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. Back in May, she paid an 11-day visit to Iran to assess the impact of sanctions on the country. During her trip, she met with Iran's human rights officials and members of non-governmental organizations. She has now released her final report on the visit and made her presentation of her findings at the UNHCR. In her report, Duhan criticized the unilateral sanctions imposed on Iran. She has also called for the removal of unilateral coercive measures and asked the U.S. to come up with mechanisms of compensation for the victims of such measures. She also noted that decades of sanctions have affected Iranian people's lives and have particularly hit the low-income section of the society. Duhan also noted that the use of unilateral sanctions, secondary sanctions, and overcompliance has had an adverse effect on the broad spectrum of human rights, civil, political, economic, social, and cultural development. Iran has suffered from the extension of U.S. jurisdiction in the international banking transactions due to the involvement of U.S. correspondent banks or payments in U.S. dollars, which has not only caused serious disruptions and delays in the provision of basic goods, but also has seriously impeded Iran's engagement in international cooperation.
The use or threat of secondary sanctions or civil and criminal penalties constitutes de facto a new form of reprisals towards individuals, states, and companies, considered to be associated with targeted entities or to circumvent unilateral sanctions regimes, despite the recognized illegality of this application of extraterritorial jurisdiction of states. Secondary sanctions and overcompliance make states, businesses, humanitarian organizations, and individuals look for alternative means to procure necessary goods, which results in growing costs, delays in delivery, growing risks of corruption and other types of transboundary crimes, and endanger the status of humanitarian organizations.
We will recall that the United Nations General Assembly in December 2020 Resolution 75181, 131 countries voted unilateral coercive measures and legislation are contrary to international law, international humanitarian law, the Charter of the United Nations, and the norms and principles governing peaceful relations among states. And it's quite simple under the Charter to show the U.S. cannot intervene and apply sanctions against your country because it's contrary to the sovereign equality of nations.
Yet, there have been opposition to her statements and places of visit. Criticism of her visit to Iran and a scathing report on the cruel U.S. sanctions have been led by Hillel Noyer, executive director of UNW. He has argued that Duhan is a lobbyist for repressive regimes. Yet Noyer himself is guilty of that. He has been a staunch supporter of the Israeli regime and supports the oppression and cruel human rights violations against Palestinians. This in turn makes him void of being impartial and a judge on human rights.
During her speech, Elena Duhon, who visited Iran recently, gave firsthand accounts of how the U.S. sanctions have severely impacted the lives of Iranians over decades. She particularly pointed out how secondary sanctions are compounding the problem. Kazem Haribabadi, Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, was also present at the session. He rejected U.S. claims of exempting food and medicines from sanctions. He called it a whitewash, saying those life-saving items never make it to Iran. Now, millions of pilgrims from across the world are converging on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala for the annual commemoration of Arba'in. The pilgrims, many of them from Iran, are making the journey towards Karbala on foot. The city houses the shrine of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. This year, the pilgrimage, which is one of the largest religious congregations in the world, reaches its peak on the 17th of September. Arba'in marks 40 days after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. On that day, the Imam and dozens of his companions were martyred during the Battle of Karbala nearly 14 centuries ago. This is considered a very important occasion for Muslims around the world. The government of Iraq is expecting nearly 20 million people to come and visit the holy shrine during this period leading up to the 17th of September, which is the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. The occasion is referred to as Arba'in, which literally translates into the number 40 in Arabic. From Iran, we know that at least until yesterday, 3 million people have crossed the land border between Iran and Iraq to take part in this ceremony. Moving on, Palestinians hold a funeral for a teen who fell victim to Israeli gunfire near the city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry identified the victim as Uday Salah, saying that he was killed by a bullet to his head. He lost his life when the Israeli military stormed his neighborhood in western Jenin overnight. The raid comes a day after two Palestinians lost their lives during an ambush against an Israeli military checkpoint near the same city, which also left an Israeli soldier dead. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hidden Files.
We
40 acres and a mule. That's right, 40 acres and a mule. After 246 years of slavery, that is what African Americans who had been enslaved were promised by the U.S. government. Well, that was back in 1865, and although that was no real compensation for 2.5 centuries of slavery, even that promise was not kept towards black Americans. It became symbolic of all the other promises, laws, programs that were supposed to bring about more economic parity with whites for black Americans, but never took place. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Today, we're going to take you on a journey that started centuries ago on the African continent and yet still has proportional consequences on millions of African Americans today. Estimates vary from $6 trillion to $60 trillion, the value of those 40 acres and a mule today. Well, the wealth never paid to the former slaves nor their descendants. The generational wealth that was never passed down, that opportunity, like so many others, that was never provided to blacks, while endless opportunities, grants, raises, stipends, etc., were given to white Americans. The results show a staggering difference between black and white wealth, even in America today.
In 2019, the median white household was worth $188,200. The median black household held $24,100 in wealth. White households had 7.8 times more wealth than blacks. In 2020, whites made up 60% of the U.S. population, but held 84% of the total household wealth. Black households, who constituted 13.4% of the U.S. population, held 4% of the total household wealth. White households inherit over 5.3 times more than black households. And white households are 2.8 times more likely than black households to inherit any wealth.
Well, we're going to dig into this issue further with our first guest, Cam Howard.
Cam Howard is a reparations expert who has been fighting for decades to get reparations for black Americans. He has addressed the United Nations and has traveled the world presenting the case for reparations for African Americans. He's an administrator for NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America.
Thanks so much for being with us. Do you think that black Americans should get reparations, and if so, why?
So I certainly believe that blacks in this country should get reparations. And it's primarily because of, you know, two reasons. One, there's never been justice and fairness in any large measure for African Americans, people of African descent in this country. As you know, we came here as stolen, kidnapped people from the continent of Africa to slave in the cotton fields and tobacco fields and rice fields in America, and then later in some of the factories during the industrial age. A tremendous amount of crimes were committed against us during the period of enslavement. But then after the period of enslavement, we had a brief period called Reconstruction in this country where there was some semblance of fairness and justice. Then that was followed by another 80 plus years of terroristic apartheid by white supremacist organizations in this country that removed, again, all notions of fairness and justice in the areas of education, in areas of economics, in the area of labor, employment, et cetera. There was criminal punishment, criminal justice. There's been no fairness. There was no fairness. It was an apartheid system backed by the terror of the state. And then after the Jim Crow period, apartheid period in this country, in 1965 and their 60s, as a result of the civil rights movement, we had a small window of fairness and justice with the Civil Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, and the Voting Rights Act that was passed. And then in the 70s, we had a semblance of fairness with affirmative action. But all those things have been stripped down, taken away the teeth of what should have been given to us in the area of fairness and justice, and they've been watered down. So when you look at the police violence in our communities, it's still a continuation of the non-fair and non-just treatment that we receive in this country. So, you know, only a brief, very brief periods in this country of African Americans ever received the type of fair and just treatment that immigrants and people who are, you know, other Americans or people who just come to America, they receive just by being on within these boundaries. But African Americans as a whole, we have not shared any type of governmental fairness and justice for the long haul. Secondly, reparations are due because of the tremendous injury that we still suffer from today as a result of these hundreds of years, centuries of mistreatment in this country. When you look at every area of people of activity in this country, Blacks on the bottom of every good list and on the top of every bad list, whether it's education, whether it's housing, whether it's criminal punishment, whether it's wealth, whether it's, you know, health, maternal mortality, infant mortality, all these things, you see a stark difference between Black lived experience and white lived experience in this country.
Well, what type of reparations are you proposing?
We look at reparations in the forms of, from the international law standpoint, of gross crimes committed by a state against the civilian population, where that tends to lay out what is known as full reparations. And there's five basic components. First component is cessation and guarantees of non-repetition. First, you must stop the bad acts. You must eliminate the public policy that disproportionately negatively affect people of African descent in this country. That's first and foremost. The criminal justice laws, the housing laws, the economic laws that exist, the disproportionate resource allocation toward education and other aspects of our community. First, you must cease those policies and then put in place structures that ensure that those policies don't show up again. Like when enslavement ended, enslavement resurfaced for another 45 years in the form of convict leasing, in the form of sharecropping, in the form of debt peonage, where, you know, that we still existed in enslavement, but it was not called enslavement. So we need to stop these bad policies that exist today and make sure that we put in structures that they don't resurface. The second component of full reparations is restitution. How do you return the people back to where they would have been had these crimes not committed? So we're talking centuries of crime. So there's going to be multiple generations of repair that's necessary in the areas of education, in the areas of economic development and wealth building and employment and these type of areas and land acquisition and housing. All these areas have to be addressed and redressed with targeted resources. The third component is compensation. When restitution doesn't alleviate a situation, the compensation is an obligatory form of reparations under international norms. And we certainly know that in order for us to have some type of parity and wealth in this country, there's going to have to be some type of direct compensation. We don't know what that be and how much it would be, but certainly we are fighting for that because it is, again, obligatory under international law to redress the situation in its entirety. The fourth component of full reparations is satisfaction. How do you return the dignity back to a people whose dignity was eroded as a result of the crimes you committed against them? Sometimes an apology will do that. Other times, you know, museums, markers, removing a statuary, creating monuments, new monuments, curriculum overhaul, truth and reconciliation commissions, those type of things lend to dignity. Return or satisfaction. And then the fifth component is rehabilitation for the mind, heart, and spirit damage to the people as a result of the crimes. Black people in America have the worst health profile among any people. Our health profile is similar to those in quote-unquote third world countries in certain areas. Highest rates of cancer, highest rate of heart attack, highest rates of infant mortality, maternal mortality, as I stated, highest rates of breast cancers among women, the highest rates of testicular cancer or prostate cancer among men. I mean, the health profile is terrible. And we know now through transgeneration epigenetic inheritance that that health profile is a result of the historical trauma we've experienced as a people in this country.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Cam Howard. we're going to take a look at a few instances that have taken place over the years and why African Americans are demanding reparations. You know, slavery launched modern capitalism and actually turned the United States into the wealthiest country in the world. Looking at this cotton production, I mean, by the 1830s, 77% of U.S. cotton was used for the British textile industry. And look at that, 2.25 billion pounds of cotton in 1859. And, you know, the cotton actually built New York City as a commercial and financial center. And if you look at the whole worth after the outbreak of the Civil War and the values of slaves, $3 billion. 48% of total wealth in the South in 1860. So very valuable commodity. The emancipation, though, of African Americans did not bring about any type of economic freedom. There were continual policies to make sure that they never got their rights, starting off, of course, with not getting the 40 acres and a mule. However, the slave owners in the South, they actually got compensation after the Civil War, $300 per slave loss or freed. And throughout the time, the safety nets for other Americans were never in place for African Americans. Not the loans, not the access to affordable housing in good neighborhoods. There was redlining to prevent them. And even when they could take off a little and be successful in some type of business, as we see like Black Wall Street, then there were efforts to totally eliminate and annihilate any type of success that they had. I mean, this is just a very, very small example of some of the reasons why African Americans are demanding reparations.
Kalonji Jamachanga currently serves as co-chair of the Urban Survival and Preparedness Institute and is co-founder of Black Power Media. He has fought on multiple fronts, tackling issues from local and national police brutality cases to international human rights violations. Under Kalonji's direction, as founder and national coordinator of the FTP movement, programs such as International Feed the People and the National Coalition to Combat Police Terrorism have matured and developed. He has shared his experiences in the best-selling book, How to Build a People's Army, and the documentary, Organizing is the New Cool.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Kalonji Jamachanga. What's your perspective in general regarding reparations?
You know, when I think of reparations, you know, most people think reparations is money. That's not what we're talking about. Our first order of operation is our political prisoners, because like any other civilized nation, whenever there is war or there's any type of, fighting or what have you, any type of disagreements, the first thing before anything can go down is they want their captives back. You know what I mean? So we want our political prisoners back first and foremost. And it is my belief that if we are, the question around reparations should also include the continent of Africa. I think that, the first thing should be, they should be paying reparations to folks on the continent because they stole not only the land, not only the minerals and the wealth, they stole us, they stole humans, you know? So, we totally believe that reparations should be paid, but will it be paid? We don't believe this country is capable of that type of, accountability or respect for us as a whole.
What type of reparations in general do you think would be necessary?
You know, land is definitely, you know, is necessary. You know, we're not just talking about some cash because we know that the U.S. dollar doesn't mean anything. And we know that if they gave us reparations with cash, then they'll just raise the prices up. They'll hike the prices up. You know, so, you know, that's a foolish notion that all we want is money. You know, we know that the American dollar has no real value across the globe. They place their own value on it. You know, so we don't want anything that they can take away. What we'd really like you said, is to be left alone. What we really like is to folks to say, you know what, we want to return these goods. We want to make good with our people. But we know that under a capitalist society, we know that capitalism is a violent system. You cannot have capitalism without the pain and suffering of others. They package it well. They make you feel comfortable, make you feel like, you know, yes, you should be a part of the capitalist system and you should grow and, you know, everything's going to be all right. But it's not the case. They let a few quote unquote African-Americans and a few so-called minorities, or should we say other oppressed people, give them the illusion of power. And, you know, power is about self-determination. So if you don't have self-determination and you don't have a place of your own and you don't have your own tongue and your own culture, then again, you are a displaced person. You are a person that's running around trying to find themselves. And that is how they have us right now. So we're talking about 500 years of this practice. This practice of terrorism. So we must understand that, unfortunately, in this country in particular, when you are, you know, their success has to equal your failure. Someone has to be at the bottom and someone has to be at the top. And in the capitalist system, the folks at the bottom will always get stepped on in order to benefit those who are at the top, the oppressors.
In your perspective, what are some of the systemic efforts that have taken place in order to prevent African Americans from achieving equality?
The whole notion of equality is a myth, because we were brought here as chattel slaves, as surplus labor. We were brought here as, you know, as treated like domesticated animals. You know, so they looked at us as property. They never looked at us as equal. You know, even on paper, they said we were 3/5 of human beings. They didn't even consider us a human being. Matter of fact, the quote unquote forefathers of this country, they treated us like objects. You know, even when you talk about folks like George Washington, these are, you know, most of the men who happened to be on the money here, the dollar bills and the cash and the coins, these are former slave masters. You know, these are folks who gave away Africans. And we don't consider ourselves slaves. We were enslaved, because we weren't slaves when we encountered these folks. So we were enslaved Africans. So, these are folks who literally gave us away. George Washington's wife gave Africans away for wedding gifts. They gave us away like we were poodles, or like we were some type of plants, or some type of exotic horse. You know what I'm saying? Like we were camels. We were treated as nothing more than, like I said, domesticated animals. Like we were tricks. We performed for these people. We worked for these people. We built for these people. And in turn, we were enslaved, we were tortured. And to this very day, we are victims of a systematic oppression, which, again, stems from capitalism and global white supremacy. This is what it's all about. You know, capitalism and enslavement are Siamese twins.
We're just about out of time, Mr. Changa, but do you have any final thoughts?
I would like to say that people of the world, oppressed people, quote unquote, third world people, we have to resist imperialism at every turn. We have to, like it says in Islam, we have to change things with our hands. And if we can't change it with our hands, we have to speak out against it. And if we don't speak out against it, then we at least have to hate it in our hearts. We have to remember that we are here for a limited time, and we have the right to exist. We have the right to love. We have the right to be our natural selves. And no man, woman, or child should be able to exploit, dominate, or oppress us.
Very powerful words. Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files. From 1619, when the first Africans were enslaved in what would become the United States, until the present, Africans and their descendants in that country have never been considered as equals with their white counterparts. They have been the victims of systemic terrorism as they have built that country, and now they are demanding their fair share of it. Will they get reparations? Will their demands be met? Not likely, but we will continue to follow their story, their cases, and their demands for justice. And we'll bring you all the latest on that right here at Hidden Files. And make sure you join me and the team right here next week as we dig into another Hidden File. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye for now.
In the limelight.
By shying away from graphic images of death, news organizations sanitize the violence of Israeli regime aggression against Palestinians. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Elise Swain and Alice Sperry, writers. This article is published under the heading, Americans rarely see the true face of Israeli regime's bombing of Gaza. Here's the story. When a ceasefire ended a three-day Israeli regime offensive in the Gaza Strip, over 350 Palestinians were wounded and 46 were dead, including 16 children, according to Palestinian officials. Media coverage in the U.S. was mainly led by photographs of smoke-filled skies or Gazans walking amid piles of rubble. While the photos were accurate and recent, the safety of selecting these images rather than graphic ones effectively portrayed a reality for American audiences far removed from what had truly unfolded on the ground. To look at the totality of images that are made during a news event is an experience most Americans, with the exception of photo editors in newsrooms, rarely experience. As the Palestinian death toll climbed over the weekend, images from photojournalists based in Gaza poured into massive databases like Getty Images and AP Images. A quick search for Gaza on Getty Images, for example, returns hundreds of recent photographs, a near-endless grid of brutality from the last week. In many images, children killed by Israeli regime bombs are displayed prominently. These images show funerals, the faces of the deceased uncovered, their bodies held aloft and marched through the streets. In some photographs, mourners are seen taking their own images of the bodies on their cell phones, proof of what horrors have occurred.
Yeah.
These graphic images are arrayed on photo databases next to the non-graphic images that are almost always selected for publication by U.S. news organizations. Rockets flying through the sky at night, quiet moments of children surveying the damage done to their homes, and black smoke rising over the horizon. In Gaza, photojournalists routinely photograph within hospitals and morgues. This access to urgent care facilities, rare in the United States, provides an opportunity for journalists to directly document the wounded and dead. On Getty Images, images of children's bodies wrapped in white fabric piling up at the morgue are abundant and uncensored. While shocking and deeply upsetting, they do show very clearly what bombing dense residential areas produces. I can still see the grieving people weeping after their homes were destroyed, Palestinian photojournalist Hossam Salem told The Intercept, adding, I can't handle it anymore. Even after these 3 days of Israeli regime attacks are over, I have become more drained than before. In Gaza, there are no stories that can give us life. All we can say is how death has taken our lives and the lives of those around us. In general, the majority of coverage by international and American media is weak and often does not show scenes where innocent women and children were killed. Soleiman Haji, a Palestinian visual journalist working in Gaza, told The Intercept, in the case of one of the 16 children killed, 5-year-old Ala Qadoum, one report in the New York Times included a photograph made after her death. This was the exception, though the photo was not featured prominently. It was placed near the end of the article. Other outlets from the Washington Post to NBC News did not publish the image, even as they mentioned the girl's killing. What we are left with is, in essence, a sanitized and avoidant understanding of world events as newsrooms uniformly opt for images that do not include any graphic content. Social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook have enforced this shift away from publishing depictions of violence by implementing sensitive media policies that discourage newsrooms from prominently displaying images of atrocities lest they lose page views. There is no consensus on how to deal with images of intense violence. Individual newsrooms make decisions on a case-by-case basis, often after sorting through troves of images filed to major distribution platforms where none of the images are blurred or censored. On Getty Images, only within the caption information is there sometimes an editor's notes warning the viewer about what they're already looking at. Image depicts death. Most media outlets, including this one, issue an editor's note or content warning before surprising viewers with depictions of graphic violence. It is not just Palestinian bodies that are erased from mass media accounts of massacres. School shootings in America and the scenes that have become visually defined by makeshift memorials and candlelit visuals rather than graphic images. And the same is true for the bloodshed that occurs overseas, but there are exceptions. The problem with the representation of Palestinian life and death goes well beyond the images selected to tell the story. Palestinians and many foreign observers have long condemned the international media for sanitizing the Zionist regime's crimes and deferring to the Israeli regime's narrative. In a letter signed by more than 500 journalists following yet another Israeli regime bombing campaign on Gaza last year, the authors, including several Intercept reporters, argued that coverage of the Israeli regime and Palestine regularly amounts to journalistic malpractice. The asymmetry in context does not just extend to the language we use. Stories tend to disproportionately amplify Israeli regime narratives while suppressing Palestinian ones, the group wrote. Obfuscating Israeli regime's oppression of Palestinians fails this industry's own objectivity standards. Ahmad Abu Artma, a Palestinian writer and human rights activist who in 2018 was one of the organizers of the Great March of Return, a peaceful protest movement by the fence separating the Zionist regime from Gaza, told Intercept that the Israeli regime operated on the assumption that they would have an ally in most of the international media. He said, "This is complicity. We don't want anything more than for people to know the facts. We don't have a complicated narrative. Our demand is only that people watch the facts, watch the reality, see the footage of what's happening." Across newsrooms, the safe choices of showing an abstracted violence, including calm moments of smoke and rubble, over overt violence, including death, injury, or mourning, fall in line with the framework of the coverage itself, which in Gaza's case regularly downplays the impact of civilians in favor of a narrative about Palestinian militancy, even as the same kind of militancy is depicted as resistance in Ukraine. Mohammad Mohawesh, an independent Palestinian journalist and researcher based in Gaza, argued in an interview with The Intercept that coverage of the latest Gaza assault, which Israeli regime officials admitted was preemptive, focused almost exclusively on the Zionist regime's ostensible justification for attack rather than its impact. And even though the majority of victims were not engaged in acts of resistance, the portrayal of Palestinian resistance, he added, stands in a stark contrast with that of the Ukrainian people. For the past month, newspapers and websites and social media have been filled with the stories of Ukrainian resistance and heroism, stories about soldiers blowing up bridges to delay the approach of Russian tanks and sacrificing themselves in the process. We have seen civilians attacking armed vehicles with whatever they have and common people receiving weapons training and digging trenches, Mohawesh said, adding, and yet, if any of these stories took place in Palestine rather than Ukraine, they would of course not be perceived as acts of heroism and resistance. They would only be classified and condemned as terror. Mohawesh stressed the comparison was not intended to diminish the resistance of the Ukrainian people, but to uphold the right to resist the occupation, military intervention of any land by any nation.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.